This meeting is being recorded in progress, indeed. Can you all hear me well enough? Okay, good. Can you hear Maggie well enough? I think that the title of tonight's talk may or may not seem to you to have anything to do with what actually happens. but this, so it goes. In my mind, I'm calling it Startling Herons in the Reeds. And I think it's the reason is that as I've been thinking about ritual and form, I have so much had this sense of how form illuminates emptiness and emptiness illuminates form. And you're going along and just sort of seeing, just seeing things, experiencing things, and then suddenly something happens, and for a second, there's a kind of vividness of how they, everything that's happening is this interplay of seeing the emptiness and seeing the form that we sometimes call rolling out and rolling in. So I'm going to invite you to kind of muse with me about some examples of what I'm talking about. And I hope I'm not, I had my annual wellness exam right before this and got back at 6:05. So I'm still a little bit in transition here, but I'm happy to tell you that all my numbers are really good. All the little numerical descriptors of my blood are happy. And my resting heart rate is 70, which is not athletic, but not bad. So something else will have to kill me besides my own behavior, I guess. So I even had this wonderful nurse practitioner listen to my carotid arteries, because when my mother was my age, she had a quadruple bypass, and I'm like, maybe there's something we don't know, you know? And she was kind enough to just take her stethoscope and listen to my carotid arteries, and she said they sounded fine. So that's the health report from here for today. So backing up a little into the early morning, I was sitting with Regan out on the terrace doing work in the room this morning. And we had, you know, I had rung my tinkly bell and he had rung the hanging bell, and we had done our bows and we had sat down in the ritual way. And a mama, a doe with her youngster, kind of youngish youngster, and her tiny fawn, tiny spotted fawn, still looking slightly wobbly, came meandering by. And then suddenly the doe made this sound and they took off. And Regan pointed over my shoulder towards the field, and I turned around, and there was Mama Bear and her cub down in the field. And so the deer were just off like a flash, and Mama Bear and her cub continued to eat choke cherries contentedly, and then wandered off across the creek and ate some more choke cherries on the other side of the creek. And what I noticed a little later, kind of reflecting on it, was that because of the form we were holding, because of the ritual space in which Regan and I were meeting, we had a kind of keenness of the awareness that all of us were held in sacred space, that we had entered the sacred space of deer and bear, and they had entered our sacred space. We didn't put that name on it, but I realized a little later that I had been feeling that. A kind of refuge space. And so I'm going to share with you some cons, but also some just associations as I started to look at where do I find this in our ways and in our words and in our traditions? Where do I find this way that ritual and form are active presence in what we do, in how we live this way? Because having done them for so long, I've been through so many phases, right? Phases of falling in love with them, phases of really not liking them, phases of just feeling bored by them, phases of falling in love with them again, phases of, you know, meeting them at the crematorium, you know, phases of hanging on to them for dear life. So many different relationships with our rituals and forms. So I'd like to just, with your, beg your indulgence while I meander a little bit and then open us for conversation about our experiences with those. So Hakuin comes up right away from his praise song with what you gain from just one meditation, which we quote often. All your crimes are wiped away. Then where are those heavens and hells? The pure land comes near. And as I reflected on that in this context, it felt a little different than my usual way of taking it. Yes, one meditation, just one meditation, has all the power of all the meditations, yes. But it's also that you sit down and do it. You know, with what you gain, what do you gain from just one meditation? Well, you gain sitting there. You gain, in a way, inhabiting the space of meditation, which is a ritual, which is a form. And it doesn't matter if you're doing it on a rock, on a hillside, in the mountains, or in the temple. It still is in some way a form, and the form is in some way defining of it, in some way a mandala, I guess I would say. Not defining, but creating that's not even quite the right word. Unfurling a protected space in which your crimes aren't even present, aren't relevant somehow, or are purified somehow. And the pure land unfurls itself with the space of your meditation, form and emptiness unfurling together. potent. And so I was thinking about the old lady on the road that I brought in Saturday, walking along, an old lady of the Pure Land faith, walking along the road, meets the Zen master. He says, "On your way to the Pure Land, eh, Granny?" She nods. "Holy Amitabha's there waiting for you, I expect." She shakes her head. "Not there? Buddha's not in his Pure Land. Where is he?" She taps twice over her heart and walks on. And so it used to be that I had in younger years maybe a slightly superior attitude towards people who thought that just by chanting Namu Amida Butsu some magic would happen. And fortunately life humbled me. And part of what I notice is that her ritual, her form of walking along, Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu, unfurls Amida, unfurls the Pure Land inside of her. Not a trivial thing. And we're prone to ritual. You know, it only takes one or two times, really, sometimes for something to become ritual. Our dogs love ritual. Our cats love ritual. Various desert tortoise loves ritual. You know, it is in the nature of life. Nothing to sneeze at. And I was noticing, and then we have Tore Zenji saying, you know, it's best to bow down. And we might think he's saying, oh, we're supposed to surrender to everybody and, you know, be a doormat. But he's just saying it's best to bow down. He's not saying it's best to surrender to the person. He's not saying it's best to accept the criticism and take it on, you know. It's best to believe them. He's not saying anything like that. He just says it's best to bow down. Again, what strikes me is the power of the physical doing of it. To rely on everything that's in the bow. What if I just bow and I don't have to think about it so much? What happens then? It's worth experimenting with it. And so another recent reminder of the power of rituals is getting on the computer with my little Lila, who will be 2 in September. And, you know, she'd like Gran to read her a book, but now she knows that she needs to say, "Read a book, please." And thank you. And she's not always sure which one is please and which one is thank you, but she gets a lot of recognition for the doing of it. And it's like, it's a ritual of empathy. It's a ritual of empathy learned very, very early. That the doing of it, in the doing of it, you recognize that somebody else might need something from you. And that good things might happen if you do it. And so I thought, yeah, that early, you know, it begins. that ritual, that form. We say please, we say thank you. And then I was thinking about putting on and taking off the rakusu. And how, again, the relationship changes, where I'm not always as consciously saying the verse of the rakusu when I put it on. And I'm curious about that. What's the deal there? But I notice that I always take it off before I go to the bathroom. And it's like, isn't that funny? I might forget to say, this is the robe of freedom, and put it on my head. But I feel different when I have it on. And if I'm in a retreat, even if I don't have it on and I head for the bathroom, I'm going to think I'm going to take it off, you know, because in some way I have it on, whether it's physically on me or not. And so what about that? What about how much of the time am I wearing the rakusu, whether I have it on or not? And what about that ritual? What about that form? What is that? And then I was thinking about the words that we recite. Your expression of the actual body is the harbor and the weir. And how are the forms that I do part of the practice of my expression of the actual body? So not only, obviously, everything that you do is your expression of the actual body, and is your harbor and your weir, and is a harbor and a weir for others. Not just your harbor and your weir, your expression of the actual body. May it be a refuge for everyone. And there's something about the particular expressions. The way that you bow becomes part of a way I know you, your particular bow. You know, Steve Milligan's particular bow. The way that we offer tea, the way that we receive tea. And that reminded me of Suzuki Roshi, of serving tea in retreat, first of all. How much the servers are always in love with serving by the end of the retreat. And how that has something to do with the particularity of offering the tea and watching someone receive the tea. And being careful, noticing when you spill the tea on their hand or whatever, you know, the particular experiences of it, and passing things to each other. Noticing how the person beside you passes you a bowl. The particularity, your expression of the actual body. And remembering Richard Baker talking about how Suzuki Roshi, when he was getting ready to offer, when he was going to pass you a cup of tea, would always bring it into his body first. Always two hands, never one-handed. Two hands, bring it into his body and then offer it, so that it's from me to you each time. And I don't know whether he was thinking about that when he was doing it. I kind of doubt it after a while. And then there's at the end of Joan Sutherland's description about our sutra book. At the back of the book, I really recommend, I like to reread it every so often. It's really lovely what she wrote about each part. But she ends by saying, life rests on a mystery that is nearer than our opinions about that mystery. Life rests on a mystery that is nearer than our opinions about that mystery. And to me, that resonated with this sense of ritual and form, that somehow our forms carry that mystery as well. She goes on to say, the mystery itself will bless us and sustain us, and we will find ourselves able to extend its beauty to others. That's on page 6-3 in your sutra book. And then another association that came up was from Grace Cooper, who, when I was a very little girl, up to 8, was the person who kept house and took care of us. She was a single black woman. She was probably in her 40s at that point. And she had this grace to her. And Gracie, when you said, hi, hello, Gracie, would always say, fine, thank you, fine. And it always felt odd to me as a little girl, because I hadn't asked her, how are you? I had just said hello. But she always responded with, fine, thank you, fine. Now, you know, she wasn't always fine. But there was something about the ritual of it that was part of the beauty of the relationship, fraught as that relationship might have been in ways I didn't know. But the ritual, have a cup of tea. And so then I was thinking about the koan, where the student asks, I'm new to this place. Tell me what to do. And the teacher says, have you had your rice gruel? Yes. Wash your bowls. And there are all kinds of ways that we take that and that we kind of inhabit that koan. But one way is just, to me, today, is connected with the form, with the ritual. There's a ritual way of washing your bowl. And you can rely on it to steady you when everything else is shaking. You can rely on it to hold the vastness for you in a way while you get completely lost in it. So an enactment, rituals as an enactment of what holds, of the truth of absence and presence. So just are you hanging in there? Couple more, okay. Thinking about the women of the Theragata, the women throughout so much of the history of Buddhism and Chan in many places. Women who would flee the oppressive circumstances of their lives, would run from marriages where they were being abused and mother-in-laws who expected literally the daughter-in-law's flesh in her soup to cure her if she was ill. The daughter-in-law was expected to cut some of the flesh from her belly and put it in her mother-in-law's soup. Conditions could be pretty darn harsh. and the chances to encounter the Dharma in a way that would be helpful and transformative were non-existent. But you could run. You could run to the monastery, to the convent, to the nunnery. And if you even could throw a shoe over the wall, you were safe. You could not be hauled back. That's ritual with power. If you could just manage to throw a shoe over the wall, you had arrived. And then in a slightly different way, I was thinking about the story about the person who is sweeping, 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 you know, not having been able to break through until the sound of the stone hits the bamboo stalk. And that, in a way, the rigidity of temple life, the simplicity of monastic life, or of any life, the places where the simple, repetitive, daily stuff holds you, can be the very open space in which something can come and fetch you. So it has nothing to do with liking the ritual or not. I don't think it really has anything to do with mindfulness in the way we usually think of mindfulness. Anyway, I'm kind of curious about that. And so, I'm about to stop, but you can imagine that, you know, there are so many different kinds of examples. So the last one I think I'll bring in is the one in which the temple is burned down in one of the endless wars and wars against Buddhism. And the neighboring priests come and say, but you were holding all the sutras, you were holding all the sacred writings. Now what? They're gone. What will we do? You know, and the master of that temple says, no, not at all, not gone. And they're like, well, what? Everything burned, you know, what are you talking about? And he just holds up his hand. And thinking about the rituals of recitation and how sometimes we think, oh gosh, you know, we say the Heart Sutra every week and we don't even think about what it means. And sometimes I wonder, why are we doing this every week? And that's why. And so there are also then, luckily, on the other hand, a whole bunch of cons in which the ritual has to get overturned, right? In which our hero, whoever our hero is of that koan, completely disregards the rituals and does something utterly unexpected. Both male and female characters doing this. And so somehow to me, those are also an honoring of the ritual. Of the ritual aspect of our practice lives. So I think I'd like to stop there. And just see what's coming forth for you and from you. Thanks for listening. And would you mind keeping on recording just for my, because I really want to be able to hear what everybody says and keep it, we won't post it, the conversation. Is that okay with everybody? Okay, I see you nodding.